Welcome to the Rock and Roll Research Podcast, where we share the super cool backstories and side gigs of the research and insights pros that you trust. Really excited today for episode 105, where I'm joined by Steve Portugal from Portugal Consulting. So let me tell you a little bit about Steve, and then we'll get into it. Now, Steve has been doing user research, user experience research, probably longer than most of us have ever known that that's a thing. So I'm surprised to see he started his consulting firm back in 2001. That's before I was introduced to UX research. So that's, that's some OG stuff right there, Steve. Good on you. That's really cool. Now, what's also really cool is Steve has written this book. It's called Interviewing Users from Rosenfeld Publishing. Subheading, How to Uncover Compelling Insights. Now, I've read this book. This is the second edition. It's a really good book. We're going to talk a little bit about that. But there's something else really kind of cool about Steve, also kind of OG. I understand that Steve was the founder of one of the, if not the earliest, internet communities devoted to the Rolling Stones. So I want to know more about that and a whole bunch of other things. So welcome to the show, Steve.
Hey, it's really great to be here. Thank you for having me.
Yeah. So before we get started, you've piqued my interest with the t-shirt. I see Ramones. It looks kind of like the Ramones logo. What's the story here?
Yeah, I was watching some indie film a couple of years ago, and a character was just they didn't say make any comment about it, but a character was wearing this shirt, and it was about Ramen, the logo of the Ramones, the typeface, the logo's sort of all been, I don't know if we can see this or not.
Oh, but yes, got Katsu there on there and all the good varieties.
Yeah. And it's, I don't know, it's sometimes fun to wear because sometimes, you, Matt, look at this and you're like, you knew exactly what the visual reference was. If you know the Ramones, you know the shirt and what it's referencing. If you don't, you think it's just a nice shirt about soup. Yes. So some people get it and some people don't, but it makes me super happy just to, and who doesn't love both Ramen and the Ramones? So just to see them kind of put together is really, it's one of my favorite shirts.
Ramen and the Ramones is a definite twofer in my book for sure. Awesome. Cool stuff. All right. So let's start with UX research. So, you are something of a luminary in the space. A lot of people have learned from you over the years via books and otherwise. How did you first get into this space and tell us about your journey?
Yeah, I think it was sort of, I guess, accidental. Like you made a reference before about when we sort of knew that research was a thing. I definitely did not know about design of any kind. Like I went to graduate school and studied human-computer interaction, which is kind of like computer science, but we think about the people part of it, but it's sort of a psychology thing.
Right.
And I came out of that program before the web. So before sort of software design was software that shipped, that came on floppy disks, sort of an experience that we had kind of over the wires, the tubes, whatever. And so the discipline of designing software was quite immature. And I kind of went into that not knowing what I was doing. I didn't have, a portfolio. I didn't have a process. I wasn't a designer. But we also didn't really have sort of a mature discipline of research. We had a little bit about usability, which was somebody made something. Let's see if someone can use it. And I was very fortunate to end up at a design consultancy that was starting to sort of experiment with how does this agency like provide value in product development? So is there something that they can do before a decision has been made about what the product is going to be? Because traditionally those agencies took physical products like hard products, and shaped them and styled them and engineered them so that they could go out into the world. Right. And they started asking kind of this business question, like how do we understand the problem space, the opportunity, and kind of create innovations that respond to that? And I was, I guess, right place, right time, even though I was not, again, not someone with like a skill set or anything like that. But this was an emerging practice. So I ended up, I want to call it apprenticing, but apprenticing sort of implies there was an established discipline and there's a path. And really, we were just figuring it out collectively. Like, what do we offer? How do we provide value? How do you conduct interviews? How do you find insights in that data? How do you kind of work with a company? How do you charge for it? How do you program manage it? Like, all of that stuff was really being figured out in the late 90s.
Right.
And probably in a few places in parallel, but there was no community. Again, there was barely an internet at that point. So it wasn't like we hung around with other, you know, nascent user research practices. We didn't have access to any of that.
Right.
So I sort of found my way into it and sort of realized, well, this is, not only is it cool, but this sort of matches how I think and lets me make connections between disparate pieces of information. And, you know, that idea of synthesis was something that I really glommed onto probably before interviewing even.
Right. Yeah. And so you've stuck with it. And certainly over that time, you've seen, you know, the demand for those kinds of services only increase exponentially, right?
Yeah, now we have a much more mature field or groups of fields or sort of sets of disciplines and practices and books and conferences and podcasts and webinars and just all the sort of knowledge and knowledge sharing that a community of practice that has now over these decades.
Yeah, definitely. And it's interesting, and just an observation, you know, having started in on the market research side of my career and spent, you know, a couple of years working exclusively in user experience, it really felt like those two disciplines had a different genesis, you know, felt like it's polling back in the day for market research. So it was more quantitative generally, but user experience research was born more out of like design sprints and things like that. And so the way you think of the dogmatism of user research versus market research is very different in that it's not nearly as dogmatic as say like market research is. I don't know if you've seen that as well.
Yeah. I mean, I think it sometimes feels like there's different camps and in fact, we don't like each other in these different camps. And I think that's changed less as people talk more about insights overall and bringing all these different skill sets and disciplines and dogmas together to get insight, because, you know, one approach, one mindset, one set of tools is good for one thing. And, you know, once you start putting them together, you get a bigger picture. It is interesting that sometimes we are using the same tools, but we're coming from a different mindset. And so how we think about it or what the language is, feels disconnected. It seems like there's less of that than I think that era you're reflecting to, but I believe that's still there, right? That you have kind of expertises that are adjacent that can collaborate if they are encouraged or welcome to collaborate.
Sure. Definitely. Cool. So let's just talk quickly about your book. Just a couple observations from my side. I really like this book because I found it to be really pragmatic. Couple things I just want to share that I like, but I like that it's sort of end to end, soup to nuts, right? So if you're a designer, all of a sudden you find yourself having to do user research, or let's say you're a market researcher and you fall into the space or whatever the case, you're starting with the business question that you need to address. You know, that's the context in which you're operating. And it takes you through to the end, which is how do you actually make an impact with what you've learned? And then, of course, all of the discipline around user interviews throughout. And so I learned a lot from this. You know, I got some great reinforcement, you know, maybe things I had forgotten. So it's really useful. But a couple things I just want to say. One is early on in the book, you have this quote, I think that sets the tone, that is, to me, like the most important thing that people need to learn, which is you say, the fact that it looks like an everyday act can make it harder to learn how to conduct a good interview. And that's the thing. It's like, oh, yeah, okay, we just need to talk to people, right? And that, you know, you've already made a mistake if you approach it from that mindset, because there's a discipline behind it, right?
Right. Right. And so thinking about unlearning, like well-honed skills, social skills, having to unlearn those. I think, and that we, and I think people can bring, like, they can succeed fairly well with their natural instincts. They can be friendly and charming and good listeners and have good body language. And that's just a way to be effective in the world and all of your relationships, work,
right.
personal, professional. But there is a point at which those instincts start to work against you, and your natural charm, or whatever, the way that we make connections with people that we're interested in a sincere way, that kind of works against you. And I think the one that I highlight the most is that, is how much we talk about ourselves. And in a social setting, you talk about yourself. I mean, most of us like to talk about ourselves a certain amount if it's comfortable. And we also talk about ourselves as a way to make connections. Mm-hmm. And in an interview, I think that's sort of the more novice mistake. We're relying on it's talking to people as an approach kind of steers you wrong.
Right.
And we can do so much more in an interview by asking that person about them. So when someone tells you, you know, they also love ramen noodles, right?
Yeah.
You don't have to follow up with yourself. Like, oh yeah,
right.
I like ramen too. You could ask more about them. What kind of ramen? Where's the best ramen that you've had? Like, the interviewer can keep expressing interest in what that person's telling them, and not sort of saying like, hey, I'm just like you. You actually don't need to do that. The message is more, hey, I'm really interested in you.
Yep.
And that's an unlearning thing. It doesn't feel, it feels sometimes rude or just feels off. But in fact, it is the practice that serves the end goal much, much better.
Yeah, cool. And to that point, you know, there's an example in this book that I really like, because we, in our day-to-day lives, we experience interviews all the time, right? So this is a kind of a pseudo interview, right? And you use the example of Marc Maron, who's, you know, one of my all-time favorite interviewers, and you show how in the context of the same interview, in one case, he does things really right. Like, he avoids making an assumption and digs deeper on something that, you know, seems like it has an obvious conclusion, but when he asks these follow-up questions, he gets the real answer. Contrast that with another one where he makes an assumption and moves on and leaves it be. And so there are things that we can learn from, you know, other people around us, you know, outside of the research sphere, right?
Absolutely, right? It's like you said, we're exposed to interviews all the time, and there's nothing like an adjacent example to teach you something, because you're not in the same learning mode. You're consuming like a consumer, or because you're interested in whoever Maron is interviewing. But I think once you start, the more you play with this space in your own work, the more you start to see it around you everywhere and pick up just these little moments of like, oh, that worked, or that didn't work. Oh, I wouldn't have done that myself, but it did. It is an interesting practice there. And yeah, to see those big successes and those big failures and be really sensitive to them, I think that's a great thing to do. You know, whether you're just learning or a lifelong learner, whatever, I think just to be aware of that stuff around you. I find it interesting and entertaining anyway, because this is a topic I care about.
Right. Yeah, cool. So I'm curious. So this is the second edition that I have, right? So there was a first edition, I think it was maybe a dozen years ago or something like that, right? So what changed in those intervening years that made you decide, you know, we really need to update this?
I mean, there is this fundamental thing that we're sort of talking about just a moment ago, the questioning and listening and those sort of human discussion skills. Like, that hasn't changed. I guess what's changed for me is around that is I've been doing it for 10 more years and I've been teaching it for 10 more years. So I have collected more examples. I've made more of my own mistakes. So I'm kind of in a better position to illustrate those same points. I think what has changed, and we sort of touched on this a little bit, like the organizational context in which research is taking place has radically changed. If you go back 10 years, there were far fewer in-house research teams. in-house research leaders who were, you know, peers with people in other disciplines, whether that's market research or engineering or, you know, whatever the, you know, marketing, design. And so, you know, the career of a researcher, someone who has that title, is different. And I think now there's a lot more, it's a lot more sort of, it's been codified a little bit more that there are, Kate Towsey coined the term people who do research. This idea that any organization has researchers, they have that title,
right?
Market researchers, user research, design research, usability, whatever. And then there are other people in that organization that are doing research and they need some of the same things. They need some different things.
Right.
So I think there's more people doing more things at sort of all these different levels. And so you see kind of operations as a, you know, as a way for the organization to be more ready to do research is something that a discipline has been built around that. We have more where compliance types of things might've been maybe more of a Wild West, you know, going back 10, 12 years.
Right.
Now, you know, I think there's support to do it properly. There's a requirement to do it properly, but there's also kind of support and infrastructure for that.
Right.
And then I think, you know, you mentioned before kind of this end-to-end thing. I think that was, you know, some stuff that I didn't talk about as much, you know, in the first edition was, what do you do with this data? And then how do you use that to really drive decisions and be an insights function, like something that helps the company succeed?
Yeah.
And so I think that that was something I wanted to say more about now, and kind of to you had articulated in a really way that makes me feel really good to go more end to end, to really try to describe,
sure,
you know, what's the problem and then how do we have impact with it?
Yeah.
So that felt like it was there, but it wasn't as built out as I think I wanted it to be, you know, after a few years to reflect.
Yeah. And sometimes that's the hard part, right? Doing the research can be, you know, relatively easy in some cases, but then all of a sudden you confront politics, you confront different communication styles. You know, how do we actually make this stick? You know, how do we drive it home? So yeah, good stuff. Good stuff. All right, so we're going to talk a little bit more about user research in a second. Let's talk some Rolling Stones, man. This story is really interesting. So this is early days. So tell me about this Rolling Stones community.
Right. Again, if you go back to this sort of like Precambrian era or whatever Mesozoic era we were in, where there was just not a lot of, the internet was a thing, but even before the web. So I think people that were, you know, using email and so on, you started to see there's some potential here to do something like bring people together. And there was Usenet, where there were discussion groups.
Yeah.
But email lists were kind of the thing. And so you had like the sort of early colonizers of the internet were, you know, deadheads, right? I think that goes back to like probably the second email message was like about, you know, which show or which solo or something. I mean, it was a huge, huge thing. I just had this idea like, there should be something for the Stones. I was like, I am a big fan and felt like there was so much more to know. And I didn't know what I didn't know, but I felt like there was something there. I actually, like, it was a weird sort of grad school hack, I guess. I was running a student volunteer program for a conference in 92, I think. And
okay.
I was able to get the grad program that I was in, the IT people created an email alias. And like, I mean, yes, all the, there's just the infrastructure that we take for granted now did not exist. And
so I'm we're on a think back in 92 dealing with that kind of stuff.
Right. I think it was a Unix system where like there was a text file that I would edit, and then every email to this alias would then generate a new email that would sit there in the queue for forever.
Yeah.
And so when that conference finished, I just didn't tell anybody, but I asked the IT people just to change the name of the list. So as far as anyone knew, it was still for this conference.
Yeah.
And so I changed the name of this list to be Undercover. That was my Rolling Stones reference.
Yeah.
And like, it was in fact the origin.
Yeah.
And I started publicizing a little bit and people started signing up. And You know, eventually, like, I moved off that technology and there started to be other places where you could pay for email lists. And, you know, I've been hosting it for the right 92. So we're like, yeah, we're 30 years plus into this list. And yeah, again, we take these things for granted, but, you know, most people hadn't met somebody through the internet. And it took a few, I think a few years after the list started, there was a tour that kicked off in Chicago and people flew from all over the place. And we like met up at a bar, I met up in somebody's backyard. And again, I think we sort of know what these experiences are like now. We do so much through kind of, you know, people's social lives or with sort of strangers or relative strangers. But it was really like a mind-blowing experience. I remember being in this guy's backyard and like, here's all those people that you only knew as just texts, like text content. We didn't have pictures. We didn't have video. We just had sort of snappy, you know, ASCII based, like, you know, rejoinders and kind of, and comments and so on. So yeah, the community still goes. Obviously everybody's 30 years older and there's other technologies and other platforms. But yeah, it's been like an amazing journey, like for community building as well as, you know, to be a fan of something.
Yeah. Yeah. And so you still have community members that, you know, were part of, you know, the very first people to join.
Yeah. Yeah. I saw one of them, a couple of them posted today. There's like a message about something today that I've known these people online kind of through Stones fandom for 30 years.
Yeah, that is so cool. That is so cool. Yeah, I just think about the technology back then and it was way over my head. It's just so much we take for granted now. It's just become so easy. But let me ask you about one other thing, because I know that with the pandemic and everything, everyone has found different ways to deal with it. And I know that you took up creative writing and I'm kind of curious about that. Can you tell us a little bit about that experience?
Yeah, I was really looking for some kind of creative expression as opposed to like creative consumption. So something to do. And, you know, I hadn't really created anything that was fiction since like high school, probably, which is going back really long time. And, thanks to remote, you know, you could take online classes. I mean, anywhere that the time zone would support you. And I signed up for a creative writing class at UCLA, which has, turns out, I mean, makes sense, I guess, a huge writing program.
Right.
All kinds of courses and short story, short fiction. And it was just so great to be learning something. I sort of forgot, maybe at my age, sort of how long it's been since I sort of started from scratch on something, and in an environment where there's all this sort of, I guess, creative writing instruction has a lot of codes to it, and, you know, here's how to give feedback, and here's how to workshop, and here, you know, all this stuff. So you're sort of thrown into this world, but there's a lot of rules that you're kind of introduced about, you know. So you critique others and you get critiqued, and both teach you how to be a better writer. Mm-hmm. And it's, you know, I've formed a community. I have my own pop-up groups where we write and critique each other, and I've taken classes a bunch of different places. And like, I'm making stuff like lowercase a art, like I'm producing stuff. And it's, I can see that I'm getting better at it. So I'm learning this skill. So it's interesting to like to go back to a 10-year-old nonfiction book and revise it, and sort of it's there were elements in common between sort of revising a nonfiction book and creating new fiction from scratch. I can't say there was like a huge correspondence, but it's almost like, you know, like writing is hard and slow and solitary, and just anything that kind of limbers up the fingers on the keyboard to make words come out.
Right.
I think is like a huge kind of bar to overcome.
Yeah.
So it was fun to be like, you know, last year I was sort of writing both. I was writing this book that you're looking at, and I was writing short fiction, and just feeling like, oh, I'm building these skills. Like I can see that I'm getting better at it. And Yeah, it's super rewarding for me. I've really gotten just so much out of it.
Yeah, I'm curious about it because this book, it doesn't, it's not super technical, right? I mean, it's a very easy read. But I'm just curious, obviously you've learned something from the creative writing that you applied to your nonfiction writing, but is it two separate brains? Do you have to put yourself in the mindset of this style or that style, or do you take what you've learned and then apply it? How does that work in your head?
I think there's sort of like this is a great question I haven't thought about. I think there's sort of the source and the execution. So, and by that I mean like what is it that you're trying to convey, and whether it's a, why is this person excited to meet the alien, or, why is Marc Maron's example sort of crucial for understanding when and how to follow up?
Right.
And then there's the execution. There's sort of using words clearly, and perhaps joyfully. I think I like language to pop just enough. And, there's the putting it on the page thing. And I think putting it on the page thing has got more in common. Where does what you want to say come from feels very, very different. I guess that's the, I could talk about work that I do in a way to help somebody understand. And I don't think that helps me invent a story that doesn't exist yet. I
Right.
think the gray area is that sort of sometimes they call it autofiction. I think people write fiction stories based on experiences that happen to them, but then they
Right.
turn them into fiction. And I've certainly done that a fair amount as well. I think where the source is for what you want to talk about feels very, very different, but sort of the mechanics. And there's probably a good way to write one, and there's many ways to write to sort of organize and tell a story of any kind,
Right.
and so the more sort of tools you have, the more options you have, and the more empowered you are. But that where it is what you want to say comes from feels really different to me.
Cool. All right. So back to user research. You've got a very interesting perspective because you're sort of growing up when this discipline was nascent, and helping to sort of create it to some extent. At the same time, you're a consumer and a user like all of us, and you experience good design and bad design. Once upon a time, you were able to fight through all of the difficulties and challenges to get things done with technology. So as you think of where it is today, where user research is today, and where it's headed, what does that look like as you look forward?
Right. I mean, I think, right now we're in this inflection point of, just I think difficulties depending on your industry or geography. And it's an interesting one because I feel like companies believe that research is important, but companies don't necessarily believe consistently that researchers are important. It goes back to that people who do research thing that, that we talked about before. But I think a lot of things are on a pendulum, right? And they go back and forth. And it doesn't mean that if we're anxious right now about, individual prospects or career prospects, I think that's very valid. And so I'm not trying to negate any of that, but I think what you see over time is that there's demand, and then there's the demand softens, and then the demand increases, or and then it goes back and forth. So I don't know. I mean, I hope I don't get proved wrong by this, but I think that the demand for researchers to do research, I think will come back. I think it's going to come back large. And it's not that people who aren't researchers do poor quality research. I think it's different, and I think there's so much need. And again, right now, I think the right companies are kind of saying, "Oh, we don't need it right now," and they're justifying that economically. But right, I mean, when have you ever worked in a situation where the amount of questions that there were that were important for decisions far outseated, that's not even a word, far outpaced and exceeded the resources available to respond to that. So that hasn't magically gone away. So I guess I feel sort of medium term enthusiastic that there's just a lot to learn, and it doesn't go away. It's not like, well, we've got the answers, now we don't need any more research. There's even in more mature product companies, I think they continue to be faced with questions of all kinds, like tactical, operational, future, you know, meaning, story, narrative, culture, all this stuff. There's all across the board, I think there's lots to be learned that lots of disciplines care about. Strategists care about research. Product people care about research. You know, yep. Designers care about research. They care about, they don't care about research. They care about the answers. They care about insights, right? That's the,
right.
They care about what we can help them understand and decide. So I don't think that's going away. And I think it might keep reshaping itself in terms of what we mean by research and who's doing research, like what activities and so on. But I guess I just see more, you know, coming. And again, sorry for anyone that like wants to slap me for saying that, because that's not where we are. Like today feels very much like, you know, somewhat of a brick wall, but I think that's going to change eventually. And I don't know when.
Yeah. I suspect you're right. Because before that tech pullback, like you said, I mean, the number of questions that had to be answered and addressed within these companies, all the user researchers that I knew on the client side were just like, oh God, they've got so much work. And then there was pullback in tech. And like you said, the researchers often were the ones who were let go, and you're left with even all those questions and even fewer people to address them. So just feels like there's sort of an inevitable pendulum swing that might come back, but we'll see. Okay, so let's talk media. Curious to know, you know, if you're taking your limited time of media to consume, whether it be for, you know, insight or inspiration or even just personal enjoyment, what is, you know, what do you turn into?
And I can give some specifics even here. I like to read. I mean, I think nothing like reading and writing together. Short fiction, science fiction. I just read this great graphic novel just the other day, which I'll specifically recommend. It's called Family Style. It's one of those books that, like, I think it's young adult, but it isn't necessarily inappropriate for an old person like myself. It's about a family coming from Vietnam and trying to make it in they come to San Jose, California, and it tells the family's life story. And one of the, I read it in one sitting, and I was sort of, I didn't want it to end when I closed the book, you know. I'm a avid TV watcher. I'm just like trying to get through as many interesting shows as I can and movies. I'm going to recommend this Apple TV show called Drops of God.
Okay. I haven't heard of that one.
Yeah. I think it's adapted from a manga, which I don't know anything about, but which apparently is very different, but it's about people that love wine and wine sort of culture and can taste things and tell you these whole stories. And I have personally zero interest in wine or any of that aspect of it, but there's something about a great story that shows people that are extremely passionate and extremely intelligent about a topic and kind of watch them, struggle to kind of rise and succeed through that. It was just like a really beautifully done thing, even though the description didn't kind of grab me. It wasn't until someone said like, oh, you should watch this, it's amazing.
Yeah. You know, my daughter just had me watch this Japanese film about a mountain climber. I don't know if you've heard about this. I have to look up the name. So, but same kind of thing. It's like, oh, okay. But it shows just the motivation, the passion to climb Mount Everest, you know, against all costs and fear of death and all that sort of thing. And it was so gripping. It was just so interesting to watch a movie that was animated like that, that told a story in such a compelling way.
I saw that. I can't remember the title either, but I saw that a couple of years ago. It was amazing.
Yeah, it was. So, hey, if you're listening to this, follow up with me because I will remember the title by the time this airs. So, cool. All right. So the big question. So I know that you're a Rolling Stones fan, right? I know that. Maybe a Ramones fan too, but my favorite question and most important because it is the Rock and Roll Research Podcast after all. Steve, okay, you're stranded on a desert island, right? You've got three records of your choosing to keep you company for the rest of your days. What are those records?
So Exile on Main Street by the Rolling Stones,
yeah,
sort of the, you know, tops all the best albums of all time kind
yep.
of list. There's just so much there to kind of experience in different ways. Phantom Power by the Tragically Hip. They're probably maybe my favorite band.
Now you're from Canada, and I was going to
That's right.
ask you about the Tragically Hip because
Yeah.
I mean, they've always won, oh, best band in Canada, right? Tragically Hip and Rush. Maybe Trump.
Yeah.
But okay,
Yes.
that's awesome. Yeah, they're a great band.
And then this is just, I don't know, my wild card is Arcade Fire. And that's because I don't know any, I guess they are Canadian as well. I don't know that I've maybe heard one of their songs once or twice. I thought if I'm going to be on a desert island for the rest of my life, I want something that I don't know, that I haven't worn out the grooves on, so to speak.
I love it.
So something to like listen to and like, I sort of trust if I was forced to like listen to Arcade Fire over and over and over again, it would kind of pay off. So that's my weird answer there.
I love that. So 105 episodes, and no one has taken that angle. You know, everyone's got an angle, but the angle of, hey, let me experience something new. I haven't heard 1,000 times already before. So yeah, that's cool. I love that. Awesome. Steve, one thing I wanted to mention that I neglected to mention also is that you have a podcast, right? Dollars to Donuts.
That's right.
That's a user researcher podcast. You want to say just a word about that real quick?
Yeah, the focus there is on people who, and we mentioned this kind of earlier on, you asked about what had changed. I said that, well, there are user research leaders in-house that we didn't have kind of going back. And so this is a podcast with people who are building and leading in-house research functions. That, yeah. So more episodes coming soon. It's been 4 years as of this recording. It's been 4 years since I posted anything, but
okay,
new ones in the pipeline.
Excellent. Good to hear. Well, Steve, congratulate you on a wonderful book. I appreciate it because I took some good lessons from it. That's available on Rosenfeld Publishing, right?
That's right.
And hey, this has been a great chat. Love your choices for the desert island. Let's talk soon, Steve, and rock and roll.
Right.